Hello and welcome to the American Shakespeare Center's podcast of The Maid's Tragedy, ASC Roundtable. This conversation with ASC actors was recorded before a live audience at the ASC's Blackfriars Playhouse in Stanton, Virginia, on March 28th, 2014.
Welcome to the Actors Scholar Council on Beaumont and Fletcher's The Maid's Tragedy. My name's Ralph Allen Cohen. I'm co-founder of the American Shakespeare Center and the director of mission, and I'm going to lead the conversation that will start with questions to the actors, but will evolve, I hope, into a conversation with our guest here today, Meg Jaster, and her students from Penn State Harrisburg, and anybody else who wants to join in. So let's start asking a question. Somebody want to say something about playing in Beaumont and Fletcher plays generally?
Should we introduce ourselves?
Oh, yes. Yes. Actually, I think I'm going to let Renee. Renee's much more awake. Right. And I'm also here with the actors. We'll start with Renee Thornton, who will, everyone will tell you who they're playing in A Maid's Tragedy. Thank you, Renee.
Hi, I am Renee Thornton, Jr., and I am playing Melanchius.
My name is Greg Phelps, and I'm playing a mentor.
I am Jonathan Holtzman. I am playing King.
I'm Abby Hawk, and I play Aspasia.
I'm Sarah Fallon, and I'm playing Evadne.
So we're going to find out now who those people are, or sort of who they are. This is a play by Beaumont and Fletcher, who were famous for doing tragic comedies. And they seem to have forgotten one part of that, at least at the end of this play. So so can y'all talk a little bit about how many of you have been in a Beaumont and Fletcher play before? I know some of you have because you were with us, but had you ever before, Jonathan?
I had not, no.
What are the other ones that we've done?
Philaster.
Philaster. And we did A King and No King many years ago.
I was in both of those.
Yes, right. So King and No King. And we've done Fletcher.
Yes.
And we have done Beaumont separately, but this is our Beaumont.
I wouldn't imagine that Philaster was written by the same, right, pair that wrote this play.
Yeah. Oh, good. Say why.
Well, I like this one better.
Again,
that's
say why.
I mean, I guess Philaster is probably more actual tragicomedy than Maid's Tragedy is, although we have discovered Maid's Tragedy is quite hilarious. And probably falls more on the tragedy side of the spectrum than Philaster does.
Well, I'm sort of using the definition of tragedy, Ms. Prism's definition of tragedy, where the good end happily and the bad end badly. Everybody kind of has, nobody ends very well. I mean, it's in that way it is a tragedy, though it is funny throughout. I mean, it has great comic moments in it. But I am really curious because between the two plays, I find them very similar, but I like this one better too. So I'm just curious why you did.
That's all I got. That's all
you got. Anybody a preference?
I can say I feel like
you in both.
Yeah, you played. There.
I was in Philaster. I was not in King and No King. But I was in Philaster. And the thing that I remember about Philaster was that it seemed to be in response to other tragedies going on at the time. It seemed to be mocking, almost a parody of other shows that were happening at the time, whereas Maid's Tragedy seems to stand alone on its own, unless there's something, some other play lost in the Apocrypha that this is a parody or a mocking of that I just don't know about. But Maid's Tragedy, like I said, seems to stand on its own. It's got its own...
Well, you play what I think is one of the hardest parts. I mean, Philaster's really a hard part because you go from, you know, I'm going to take care of it to I'm going to die of a broken heart. To, I mean, you go so many places with that, which is, I think, of it was a hard, hard route to take and was incredibly good. This doesn't have that same sort of thing, the sadness, the great sadness, the sort is spread into different characters and... They have pretty direct paths and they don't fluctuate. Is that some of it, do you think?
I'm sure that's got something to do with it. It's not just one dude being surrounded by other people going like, "What are you doing? Don't try to kill yourself again." Everybody's trying to kill themselves in Maid's Tragedy. Everybody is sad. I mean, the scope of it, the stakes are so high for almost everyone that. Maybe that's what it is. The tragedy is just sort of spread out across more characters.
Anybody else on?
Now that I'm thinking about it more, I can see the aside patterns are similar. Like, there's a weird thing in Mage Tragedy where people are having quite lengthy conversations with the audience while the other character is kind of like, hello? And I remember that happening in Philaster, too, that those lords had sort of long, long asides with other people having to figure out how to fill that, which doesn't happen quite in the same way in Shakespeare, except for maybe in that scene in Henry VI, 1 with Margaret and Suffolk. Yeah. But that's kind of an exception. Yeah.
Where they hear each other and they don't hear each other. That's a great thing. Let's go on to the question about women in this play, because I think it's a really fascinating thing when you look at Fletcher's plays and Beaumont and Fletcher's, but Fletcher's too. But we have two women, one of whom is in a very bad predicament, and the other one is jilted because of it. So it might be helpful to the discussion for anybody listening to this to know that the kind of given of this play is that Evadne marries a mentor at the very beginning, only we discover that it's a phony marriage, that this marriage is set up by the king, boo, by the king who wants to sleep with herself. So they're lovers, and so a mentor can marry her but never sleep with her, and in the meantime has to jilt his former girlfriend, Aspasia.
Fiance.
And she's pretty dead. So that's how this play begins. That's the opening of this play. Those are the circumstances. So what did you think, Sarah, in terms of playing this character?
I think she is fantastic, and I think that she reads very modern. And something that in feedback that I've been getting about this play is that there's something that reads very modern about her. That there's something that there's an ownership that she has of the position that she's in at the beginning of this play before the repentance happens, that she's pretty brazen about it. Not to the world, but to the people that it matters to. She knows what she wants, and she's not afraid to talk about that in a very open way. There's not a lot of, she's not modest about it. You know, the things that she says in this play are just pretty great.
Right there.
Pretty great, and I think that although the switch happens, I think she remains a pretty strong woman until the end. Even that repentance is strong.
And the repentance comes mostly through what?
Through being terrorized by her brother. I mean, that's the turning point, certainly, in the play, is that, because it doesn't happen when a mentor speaks to her. A mentor tries to change her mind about things, but she's not in a place where she's going to change her mind. The king comes in and gets a very different idea about what's been happening and believes that she has slept with a mentor when she swore that she wouldn't. And at that point, we find out that she's not in love with the king per se. She's in love with whoever has the most power.
Those lines are great.
Yeah. I love with my ambition, not with my eyes.
Yeah,
love with my ambition, not with my eyes.
Wow.
And there's something about that that reads very modern to me. There's a very modern sense to her.
Is there a particular thing Melantia says to you that in particular you hear when Renee is saying it that you're working off of for your...
I think that it is definitely a progression because she fights it for quite some time. She fights it before she's even willing to tell him, even though he already knows. He is pushing her to say... He's heard it from his best friend. Now he needs to hear it from his sister because it took him a long time to even believe it from his best friend. Now he's here and he wants to hear it from her and she doesn't give it up right away. In fact, she's quite saucy with him in the beginning. He's saying, where's your virtue? You're a whore. And she is not giving up. She's not giving up the info. And so I think that it's definitely a progression. And I think once she gets a sense that he does actually know something real is going on and this isn't just passing gossip that maybe he's heard, that's a turning point for her. And he also severs himself from her in a way. He says, you know, let the goat be thy brother, and I'm not your brother. I'm as far from being your brother as you are from your virtue. And so I think that that's when it starts to sink in that she's not only been living this secret cloak and dagger life that she's given away her honor in, but she's also stained the honor of the family, and then she's also stained the honor of a mentor. And Aspasia. Aspasia doesn't come into it as much for her, but it all starts to sort of pile on, and I think she starts to figure
out. So you're playing a very modern woman in many ways, right?
Yeah.
So what about you, Abby? What do you do with the fact you sort of Ophelia-like in the beginning?
I was just thinking of the Ophelia trope. I think Aspasia is a bit more creative than she is. Yeah, I would say it's a bit more streamlined than most of the other characters in the play. I mean, she sort of starts low and just goes lower. but there's something about, you know, what other people say about her. There's that great, in the first scene, Josh's character, you know, describes her going into the woods with her ladies and laying on the ground and
oh, it really
corpse,
sounds like
know?
Ophelia.
It's
yeah.
very Ophelia-esque, yes, but then whenever she says farewell to a mentor, she says, "So with prayers I leave you and must try some yet unpracticed way to grieve and die." So she's like coming up with how, I mean, what's the...
I love that she kisses him too. Like, mm-hmm. that mm-hmm. seems like a really bold decision mm-hmm. for her to make. I really like it.
Yeah, so I think she's maybe not necessarily always in control, but she's very artistic, and she wants to turn this into something of value, you know, her last actions.
Before you leave that, may I?
Please.
Something that Greg said last night at the talk back really struck home to me with regard to your character, because when on the page, she's very Ophelia-like, and she's really whiny, and she goes on, and she's, not only am I going to be in grief, but grieving, but y'all are going to join me, and everybody's going to be, and she's upset with the women who don't join her, and I mean, she's really cheeky. But Greg last night talked about the value of the word in this play, and that if you give your word, it means something. And on the way back, I was saying that makes a spacious play much more understandable for me. You had his word. I mean, you know, and again, the Evadne character, in light of having a relationship with a man, seems so modern, and yours seems so medieval. Mm-hmm. Unless you consider this notion of the word and he had given his word, and yeah, so it made the whole thing for her more sympathetic. When I said I had issues, I don't mean with you guys. I meant with the play we had issues. Generically, it's very upsetting, and even having seen Philaster, because I really expected to laugh more, and I felt that the play was so sad. When you killed yourself there on the bed, I didn't find it funny at all. I thought I was going to laugh. Mm-hmm. Mind you, as a stage historian, I and my crew are used to looking at things from the point of view of male actors. And I kept saying to them, how are we going to take this seriously with these women saying, I'm really powerful, or pretending to be, and yet this would have been a male, of either a boy or a man, saying these roles in this. It's still 1623. It's still pre-Restoration. So I was expecting to think it was funnier, but I think because they were female. So that's the second point. The first one was the word thing that you said. The second was this. Generically, I was more confused than I would have been, I think, because I did think it was very melodramatic on the page. When we talked about it, we acted it out in class, it was funny.
Well, you bring up something I think I discover every time we have a play that that if you look at it on the page, you go, I don't know. And then people who are good actors make, you know. So, like, for example, I talked about the Ophelia trope, I mean, a lot about this play, because just having read it. And I saw it because I saw the grad students do it one time, but even then it was different, and obviously performances were different. And I felt like in looking at Aspasia, it looked so much like hand to the forehead, you know, and tears and Ophelia. But when you see somebody come out and embody it, and that person has strength, even if that strength is a strength about sorrow, it really can change, you know. And I had that same feeling about Philaster too. I mean, you read the text, and you could, and it can be funny. I'll kill myself. I won't kill myself. I'll kill myself. I'll kill somebody else. I'll kill myself. And it's sort of back and forth. But when somebody's doing it and motivating those lines, I think it really changes.
It changes so much from audience to audience, too. I mean, like, was that opening that you would have thought we were doing Comedy Bears or sort of Two Masters or something like that? I mean, the audience thought it was the funniest damn thing they had ever seen. And we haven't had it quite that much again, but that's kind of our opening. Not audiences are anyway. But I've been fascinated by how it has varied over performances. I mean, we've done four performances of it. So.
There's four of it, and there's just two more coming, right?
Correct.
That's correct. So six.
Three more, I think.
Three. Yeah, right. Sunday.
One, then two next week.
Yes.
So you do.
So we're halfway through the run.
Yeah.
How does that feel about the show?
That's so disappointing.
So I take it y'all like the show.
I love doing the show.
Yeah.
And it's always sort of the problem for me when I felt the same thing with Dido.
Dido,
you get to that fifth show, and right about the time that you're feeling your groove is when you close. And I am fascinated, even more so than with Dido, in this, it's the difference of the audiences, and it's whatever they're coming to the table with already, their expectations, whether or not they know the play, but the way that they respond in these scenes is just, it's quite fascinating, and I don't know that we're going to find our rhythm. I don't know that there is one in this amount of time to actually go, oh yeah, that's where they laugh, or that's where I hold for a laugh. They're constantly surprising us, and I think we're still figuring out exactly
where it is,
and that's fun. But I love to see how audiences react to this. And the moment in the bed, which I wish I could have a shot of the audience every time when I actually go for the groin, because out of the corner of my eye, I see women hiding their faces. I see men kind of going, I see people laughing. There are so many varied reactions in every part of this play. But where there's the comedy, where's the drama, I think that our audiences are as surprised at the text as we are.
Yeah.
In different places.
What percentage of the house were our Harrisburg people?
Well, we only have 58 pre-sold, so I'd say about
half.
Yeah, almost half last night.
And y'all knew what was coming. Because Meg made you know. Right? So you knew what was coming because you've been studying it, right? I wonder, too, how that affects that moment.
Yeah,
you know, with,
absolutely.
With this number of people being, you know, that percentage of the house being...
Because I would hazard a guess that most of our audience members probably do not know this
play. Yeah.
And the title is perhaps a little misleading.
All they have to do is give the apostrophe.
Yeah.
Two of us.
But, Sarah, you mentioned the Dido. That's what I thought about last night in the performance, was both of you in Dido. And you, because of, you know, Dido was one of my most loved characters, and then, of course, she screws up. And I see Elizabeth, I see that as an Elizabeth thing, and I love Marlowe. And if you remember...
Screws up, I just want to interrupt. Screws up is academic for...
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, I'm making a joke. It's a real euphemism for really, really something.
She has all this wonderful power, you know, and then... Yeah, he comes along.
Guys.
Men.
Yeah.
Men.
But you said that, Renee.
Not
that
any man.
When we came, it was a Thursday night that time too, and we were all sitting in the front, and you said they'd not had an audience like that. And then in the talk back, my people were like, why did you do this line this way, and things like that. The other reason that I was reminded of your performance was that we discussed in class how Melancius in the scholarship and maybe on the page by Beaumont and Fletcher is supposed to be the moral center. And if he is, he's as problematic a moral center for me as Aeneas was, which is problematic. I think the students liked him better than they thought they would with your performance. I know we all loved Amintor better than we thought we would. We were really upset at how badly poor Amintore is treated in the play. But Melancia's, I don't know, maybe, does anybody else feel this way about that character?
About him being the moral center?
Yeah, did you think he was?
Well, I think he is for Evadne, but I mean, if I looked at the whole structure of the play, I would think Amintore is more of the moral center of the play, but...
Maybe binary?
Yeah, the pair of you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, when I start to lose it, he brings me back.
Right.
When he starts to lose it, I bring him back.
That's true.
So you guys worked off a few scripts of this, right? So I'm really interested about Jonathan's King. So you're working off of it.
Not
few
the moral center, by the way.
To what extent?
Not the moral.
To what extent that you're reading your Q script and you're looking at your lines and you're thinking, to what extent are you thinking I am not the moral center, or to what extent are you thinking something else? I mean, what was your approach to the what you're doing?
Well, being play five in Wren season, sort of no idea. I mean, at the first table read, you're sort of like, oh my God, wow, I'm a really horrible human being. Without a very serious or substantial arc to me.
Right.
Like, I'm just sort of
float
along this plane of malevolence into death. But it was sort of astounding to find out how, especially my scene with the mentor, like just how horrifyingly awful I can be to this human being, and pure apathy about it, you know, just, that scene is always really, really difficult to do as Jonathan.
Do you have anything from your past that you performed that you used as a part of your bag of tricks for that? Or?
I don't know if there's been anything so unilaterally... just bad. I mean, he's just a bad guy. But I was saying to these guys, on the spectrum of bad kings, and I will continue to forward this argument, on the spectrum of bad kings throughout literature, he's not, I mean, his wrongs are small time. They are. We were looking at Henry VIII and Richard III. And
there you go.
His wrongs are small time.
There you go.
Yeah. So that makes me feel a little better.
Whatever it
takes. Tell me about production backstage with it. I mean, some of the production special problems y'all found as you were putting this together, that if one of you were going to direct it yourselves, you would say right away to the cast, well, this is going to be an issue, I'm going to have to do these things.
You
was there anything
bed.
Special?
You need a bed. I mean,
something you can tie somebody to as well. I mean,
so you have to have uprights for the bed.
Yeah, so that's a thing.
We were quite struggled a bit with the banquet
scene. Yeah.
Because there's these conversations that need to happen, and there are public conversations and private conversations, and we just sort of like settled on this long table because it was kind of
the best.
Ended up being the most immediate choice. But I think if we had more rehearsal time, we probably could have come up with a better option.
We tried
because even the option we settled with kind of has its issues too.
We tried several configurations of tables. So is it one
big table
and then like a kid's table and another kid's table? Or how? Because there are these weird, and we've struggled a lot with what was public and what was private in that scene. And there was a question of, okay, do, as somebody who doesn't have a line, do I hear that?
Right.
Oh, I don't hear that, but I do hear this.
Right. So that's a little like what I heard from the Epicene group, too, that there was some of the similar issues with that.
Epicene,
right?
I mean, that whole play was full of scenes like that.
Right.
But with this, we have the bank.
That was really
was
the only...
Tough.
And there's also that weird, like... We struggled with the door. I mean, we struggled with the door issues in the bed, but we also struggled with the door issues in the first party scene, the people coming to the mask, because there's this, like, there's a crowd of people trying to get into this space, but there's also another group of people sitting near the king, but not on stage, somehow off stage, and, like, it's quite confusing where people are supposed to be, and if we had 10 more actors in the cast, maybe less confusing, but with 11 or 12 people, it was quite challenging.
Well, I thought the mask was lovely. I mean, talk about putting that together.
Well, no one's ever
friends.
Here.
That was Tracy
Thomason choreographed it, and Renee cut the play, so Renee also had to cut certain things about that mask just because of personnel and what we have. And then even after that, The actors themselves did some conflation because they decided that it would be easier to make two characters into one that they were sharing. So both Andrew and Tim are the knight together.
Right,
and initially they had been two different people, and that was going to be confusing to an audience. So that's, we tried to streamline it as much as we could because it's a weird, it's a weird little mask. It doesn't necessarily further the action of the play.
And it comes so early.
It comes
way early.
Yeah.
And we did not have a lot of personnel available for it, where most of the other characters are on stage, and if we wanted music to be played, I think we were very limited.
Yeah.
Speaking of which, Chris Johnston and Josh Innerst worked like madmen to get that song in the place that it was. And I love it. That's one of my favorite songs.
When it comes back later.
Yeah.
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 It's beautiful.
Awesome.
It's work. Okay, so those things. So you cut it. And is there something, if you could put any one thing back, you'd put back, and you didn't have the space for it or not?
Cut more, actually. Well, because one of the tricky things was figuring out where to put the interlude for this play. It's a little bit later than I really wanted it to be, but then that made the second half.
Yeah, it's always a
300 lines longer than the first half. And so I maybe would have trimmed it down a little bit more to make the first half not quite so long.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, there weren't, you know, I would obviously do it differently if we had five more people. That was the real challenge.
Well, sometimes
those sections, you know, and we've fudged some things, but we have, you know, from the mask scene into the first Evadne's bedroom scene where all four actresses are on stage and all four actresses were just on stage.
Yeah, that was
only
probably
two of them are playing the same character.
Right.
And that was a real, like, tricksy
part. Well, what if there had been an interlude there? I mean, I'm just saying, because that was probably where an interlude gave, giving people plenty of time.
Oh, sure.
Well, then
you
would have had multiple. Yeah, if
you
had
multiple. It would have been early. For us, at the last.
No, I know. If you're doing just one, that's why, you know, I think there were, we think there were four.
That
would that have been a, would that have been about a four?
Yeah.
Way
easier.
Yeah.
Exactly. And I know I've asked this of y'all before, but the language with Beaumont and Fletcher, people normally say it's pretty easy to deal with. Is that how you feel about this language? Or?
For the most part, yes. I remember some passages that I was just like, why is it in that order? But for the most part, it actually came fairly easily.
Yeah, I found it surprisingly easy to memorize.
Yeah.
I'm going to disagree.
Yeah.
Circle gets the square. Thank you.
Do you think it was harder than Philaster?
All right. I've got a couple of things
here's
to say.
Here's the difference.
Yeah.
Whoever edited that copy of Philaster had no idea what the hell they were doing.
Mm.
They set up things that seemed to be in verse structure that were not in verse structure. Whether or not that was a detriment of Beaumont and Fletcher, or one or the other, which I think one is better than the other. Verse tends to help us. That seems to be the reason why it was so popular and why playwrights wrote in them a lot. It helps the actors to memorize. There's clues in there that we've all learned from Shakespeare, from Middleton, from Marlowe, from other people of the same early modern English time period. And that did not help at all. In fact, it got in the way when I was trying to learn Philaster. And it wasn't until I just completely ignored the verse that I was able to get the through line of the thoughts in that was like, oh, this makes way more sense. I found that.
And then once you, I'm sorry if you say, so once the through line, the thought was clear to you, and the inflections because of the thought, you didn't see that aligned particularly with the verse anyhow.
Right, correct.
Right, okay.
Now with this, the verse is so regular, in my lines anyway, that I was like, oh, okay, here we go, back to actual regular lines of verse, but still I have to kind of ignore it. In order to get the through line of the thought, because there's a lot of like half lines and like caesuras and interjections in between, and there's not a lot of parentheticals, but every now and then that'll show up, and it shows up in a really strange spot, for me anyway, looking at it on the page, so that when it came around to like going from looking at it on the page to just thinking about what it was I was saying, it was a very difficult transition.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's a little bit easier. I'm starting to feel things a little bit better. But in terms of memorization, it's still slightly more difficult. And I'm wondering if that has anything to do with the time period, if it was because it was later.
Well, it's really 1609 to 1611 and published in 1619,
like,
right?
Like the 1560s,
so it's not,
or
it's not
like that.
1560s. No.
Right.
No, I know. It is. It's because it's gotten... Yeah, it is.
So there's
where
so,
people
so the structure
more, yeah,
is
right.
there, but I feel like in within the structure there's a bit more, it's a bit more loose.
Right.
Yeah.
You don't feel like they're, and this is something that could be probably commended for whichever author it is. It doesn't feel like they're trying to like put a square peg in a round hole. They're just
it's
talking.
Just a thought that needs
it's
to
a thought
going.
That needs to, and it just keeps going, but it's structured really well in the verse. That being said, I'm fairly certain I really don't like Beaumont. That guy can. Yeah. From what I've worked on with like Fletcher,
right.
And I know Fletcher. I think Fletcher worked.
So when it's Beaumont and Fletcher, it's less pleasant for you.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I like Fletcher.
Okay. All right.
That guy's okay by me.
But you've been in one of our pestles, haven't you?
Negative. No.
Okay. Since that's all Beaumont.
Right.
Those guys. Okay.
Yeah.
Anybody else, though, on that? I mean, maybe different from... Maybe if you're romantic leads, it's all screwed up, you know, and both of them.
I found, as far as the verse is concerned, some passages are super regular, and then others...
Just not at all.
Not. But line-wise, you can really track it by the lines and use that, but I found it's...
So by that, I just want to be clear what you mean by that. So the verse isn't being regular within the line,
but
the line is being regular in terms of a thought. Is it a thought
even,
or not?
It's just that the line is being helpful.
It's being helpful.
The line is giving you a moment to, you know, giving you a moment to turn the phrase.
Right.
Giving you a moment's pause to continue on with this thought, or to shape the thought, yeah. But then some of them are super regular, you know, right on verse, so.
That's probably the Fletcher.
Clearly.
But I didn't find the others to be difficult to memorize either. It was kind of striking how different it can be.
What did you think about Epicene?
There's a lot of Latin in that.
yeah,
it
you
was,
guys
do
imagine.
It was tough. I don't have a ton in Epicene, but it was...
Yeah.
It does not come to
the
barber's
there. Yeah. Any thoughts, Jonathan, of the five this year?
I think that for maids, in terms of the verse, I have roundly ignored it. It was purely unhelpful for the king. God, the language in Epicene is something entirely otherworldly. I still don't know how to wrap my head around that, and my line notes will suggest the same.
Well, I think, let me see if I have any other questions about, oh yeah, favorite moments. I do like to do favorite moments in the play. I mean, you've only had four audiences so far. So is there a moment you're looking forward to, or you just can't wait to try it again?
One of the things I really love about this play, and the thing that appeals so strongly to me, is the Melanchius mentor relationship. You know, it's, Greg and I did play... Balthasar, what is his name? Bassanio and Antonio, which is, it's an echo of that. But I have never quite read such a powerfully strong male-male relationship that wasn't sexual. And that, you know, when they meet each other, Melanchius says, not all the cries of, or like, thy mother could no more but weep for joy to see thee after long absence. All the wounds I have fetched not so much away, nor all the cries of widowed mothers. But this is peace, and that was war. I mean, like, that's intense.
And at the end, his sister is dead.
Yeah.
His other brother says, you're losing yourself in sorrow over there, with, but your sister's dead here. And he goes, no, this is my sister, this is my father, this is my, I mean, that's strong.
Yeah.
Your sister's dead over there, and you're the one who asked her to kill the king, and it's all about a mentor.
I mean, my sister was a whore, but...
She soft with her ambition.
Yes.
That's all.
Worse than that final.
But that's
but
really
there
intense.
Is, and like
it's
that thing Greg was saying earlier about, like, when he goes off the rail, Melanchius brings him back, and Melanchius goes... Like, there's just something really powerful about this relationship that I find fascinating and kind of unique in other plays of this period that we have done.
Well, I mean, there's a lot of playing with very youthful men being, you know, there's Two Gentlemen and mm-hmm. you know, being, and then Two Noble Kinsmen, mm-hmm. being where their bond is bigger than their interest in others. But that's always something they sort of are supposed to grow out of. Yeah. In this yeah. play, it is a sort of moral center for us. I mean, between the two of them, they become yeah. a... I saw a question, I think somebody had a hand up, or not, over there. Do we have a comment from Harrisburg? Or Monica, do you have a comment? Please,
hi.
Please, you're going to have to come further, okay. I think.
I'm Monica Cross. I'm the Playhouse Manager here at the American Shakespeare Center, and I actually had a question about the women in this play, because, you know, it is the Maid's Tragedy, and you really only get that one scene with the after the wedding where all of the women are sort of getting Evadne ready, and it's also a very interesting scene because, you know, Aspasia is there having been the woman that was supposed to be the one getting married, and between that... Oh, so many thoughts. Between that and the marriage scene in Epicene, where you have, like, this woman getting married and all of the other women coming to wish her well, and I was just wondering if you could talk about what those group women scenes are like, because they don't happen very often in early modern drama.
You're right that they don't happen very often. It's one of the things that I actually love about it, and I thought that when I saw that Aspasia was in this scene, you know, I decided that I was like, I think that the ladies, it would be great to have the ladies doing something, you know, to help get me ready. And I approached Abby and said, do you feel like your character wants to be involved in getting me ready, or do you feel like you don't? And I said, you know, obviously it's Ren season, so it's her character, but she's clearly in the scene, mm-hmm. and it's clearly a getting ready thing. And I said, you know, it's fine if you don't want to do anything. If you do, I've got a job for you. You know, and I think it might be kind of awful awesome if she is having to do something to get this woman ready for the man that she was wanting to marry.
And it is.
Yeah, I think so too. And
yeah,
so, I mean,
and
we,
I think
we had that discussion.
That she's in that scene, and it's not to be brooding in the corner.
Yeah. And she says, this should have all been for me.
Right.
This all should have been for me. And it's, I think it's a very lovely, open, there's a lot of different dynamics going on in that scene, because you start off with Dula and Evadne, and it's sort of jokey-jokey.
Dula is one of my favorite parts.
Dula's great. Dula's great. She's so amazing. But it starts off this jokey-jokey, let's get you ready for your wedding night, and then we shift into sort of a spacious sorrow about it, and then Evadne kind of trying to bring it all back and going.
It's really amazing when you look at the text. You have no idea Aspasia is in the room for until somebody finally refers to. I mean, she finally.
I bring her up.
You bring her. Yeah.
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 So yeah, I bring her up.
It's really
It's like, stop being sad. I mean, I know that's rough, but come on.
Right. Oh yes.
But it's a great opportunity because you don't get those scenes. I mean, Monica's absolutely right. Is that as women, it's very rare that you get something like that.
And for Aspasia to speak up during the scene, you know, in other
not
plays,
have a soliloquy
it would be
afterwards,
mm-hmm. be like, oh my God, my life sucks.
Yeah.
But she's like, no, we're going to talk about this
now.
Right
now. Yeah. Yeah. Well, in their relationship, I mean, I'm not blaming her. I say, pardon me, but I know it's not her fault, you know? It's the women understand the predicament of women,
yeah.
and I know that she didn't choose this. I know that it was this guy that put us in this situation, and it's not, you know.
Well, that brings me to a question. I know I'd asked before, and I still want to get back to favorite scenes, and I've forgotten. But a mentor has to, like, it's like, a mentor sort of, oh, yeah, I did actually promise you that. Yes, we did have.
Yeah.
But, you know, now I'm not. There's a sort of thing going on there. How did you sort of deal with that? You know, this is not who I was going to, but now I've got to, and I'm going to do my best at it. Do you know what I'm...
I think so. I think what you're...
I'm saying there's not... You don't feel it, to me, your character, and I don't mean your performance. I mean, even in a reading, it looks like, yes, that's true, but now this is true. And and your regret over that seems tempered by the absolute necessity of this other thing.
Yup. I mean, again, it goes back to honor. It goes back to, and a mentor's absolute dread and fear and awe of the king. He does whatever he says, and he's put there by God. He doesn't really bring up religion all that much, but I mean, I think that's how he sees him, as the person who, despite anything, he has to follow and love and obey. Which again comes up a little bit later. But in terms of leaving Aspasia for Evadne, I feel like it's gotta hurt him, because he keeps bringing it up time and time again. Like the wrong I did to Aspasia, he acknowledges that it's not okay. And right after that scene that we were just talking about, the scene where Aspasia kind of confronts Amintor and leaves, he says, I did that lady wrong. Methinks I feel her grief shoot suddenly through all my veins. Like, he's like, I feel sorrow for this, but as soon as Evadne comes on, everything's okay.
Right. And even the line, I'll say the line again you just said. Methinks
I feel her sorrow shoot suddenly through all my veins.
Right, like shoot suddenly. Instead of that it would have been there anyhow.
Yeah.
And it's this thing about the play, I guess this is me just going off a second. I don't usually find things in these plays that seem foreign to me. My whole thing is, and maybe to an excess, is that, we're fundamentally, our hearts work as they have worked for 5,000, 6,000, however long they have been working, that we laugh at the same things. The world must be people just funny today for the same reasons it was funny years ago. These things, to me, suggest a sort of essential selves, a human person. But when I see this play, and there are some kind of like it, where the king's word is so important and heavy a thing, and then I start to think about, losing Elizabeth's favor, if you don't get her permission, even get her permission for a marriage, much less whether or not she wants you herself, it begins to make me think, a wobblier on my sense that finally we can look at these plays and see our worlds clearly, because sometimes it's through a glass. And in this case, this is the king, primarily. That's why I keep looking over at you.
The king's impotence is also there. I mean, I think that the way people turn on him, first of all, the way Greg sort of deftly goes between, you're a man standing there and I will kill you. Oh, but you're the king. Obviously you're there by divinity. And then Melanchthon's decision to take up the fort and kill me. I mean, this is...
Melanchthon, doesn't...
You go there.
Seem to have the same... for the king, and maybe that's partly because he mostly spends his time away from court, so he's an outsider in some aspects of this sort of bubble that the king has created, and he sort of shatters it.
I don't think it's a reach to say that the whole idea of the divine right of kings, which had been out there but never really got going until the Tudors and the Stuarts needed it, and it's almost as though Beaumont and Fletcher brought in Melanchthon from a world outside of the idea that there's this divine right of kings and the king can be wrong. But to me, that answers a lot of issues about Amintor, which is like the king. It's the king.
One of my favorite lines when Melanchthon says in front of a full court of people, where I am clear, I will not take forgiveness of the gods, much less of you.
That's good stuff.
That's ballsy.
Yeah.
And then less attitude, but with a similar purpose, like this arm has stayed your foes, how can you bring this strange distrust?
You are sitting here because of me.
Absolutely, which is irreverent.
Yeah.
So let's go back to favorite moments, please. And as a way of sort of promoting the thing, if people are listening. By the time this gets posted,
will be long.
The show will be gone. So favorite moments, anybody? You can't wait. You as an actor, this is going to be fun. I'm going to enjoy this moment. Let's start with the king, where I should start.
Thank you. Divinity gives me the right.
Yeah, right.
I think that when my wrists are bound to the bed,
God, it really begins for me. think when my wrists were tied to the bed.
There is one. That whole scene is unbelievable. Playing with Sarah in that capacity is just ridiculously fun and amazing and frightening. There's one line that is a really difficult line because I really don't want to get a laugh on it, but it's also super funny, which is just when she tells me, you know, I sort of wake up and think that this is going to be a really,
really
awesome new sexual escapade, and then she says, you have to bleed. I just sort of pick my head up and go, bleed.
We haven't done that before. That's great.
But I love the laughter that's in that scene, too. Everybody knows what she's coming to do, and she's in her own space. But then the minute that the king wakes up, that there is this, that it takes him a long time to wake up, and she's like, oh my God, is he dead already? And then he wakes up, and it's like, oh my God. You know? And there are these really light moments that live right up against, and then all of a sudden you've got people, you know, and by the end of it, people are like, ooh, I don't want to see that anymore, and it's a bloody mess. But I love that all of that lives all together in about, you know, maybe 7-8 minutes. That's all right
there. I love the reverse Desdemona moment that Sarah gets in that scene. You know, having played Desdemona twice, to then get to play someone who comes with a candle and a knife to commit this murder. I mean, I love that she gets
on that
bed.
Turn.
Well, our audiences have, you know, a lot of our audiences have seen that.
Sure,
so I'm sure,
sure
it's a treat for them as well.
During our first performance, when I was lying there just newly dead, I heard somebody whisper off stage, right, yay, Sarah.
It's pretty crazy.
Especially, do you have a...
It's hard, because there are really just the three scenes that she has, aside from that quick pass at the beginning. But I do love the final scene. I mean, that's just great. I'm disguised as a boy. I'm coming to pick a fight. I don't know how to fight. I have a, you know, and I... Just the whole experience of that last scene is pretty awesome.
Is it?
Can I help her? You get to kick him. Come on.
Yeah, who said that last night? There was this whole rumbling murmur of, oh, kicking, oh, kicking.
I'm sorry, it was probably... I mean, next to Exit Pursued by a Bear, I now have a new favorite stage direction. Kicks him. That is wonderful. And it does, just like I say real quickly, that it fits into my notion of this play as parodic of so many others, including all those moments in the comedies when the guys really don't want to fight with each other. Aventura doesn't want to fight with her because, you know, of his reasons, and she doesn't know how to fight. That's brilliant, but I think it's also parodic of that. And if I could just mention your character again, that returning soldier trope, that it would, if you say this is 1609, I thought it was later, isn't that then on the stage with Coriolanus? And wouldn't that in
fact
be
parodic? It would
be
near the time of Coriolanus, yeah.
No, and Coriolanus says, I will not show, and he's like, I got wounds here, you know? And I found it funny that he would be saying that, and if they're on the boards at the same time, maybe I'm right.
That's really interesting. That's good.
It's hard. I look forward to doing this play every time because of the short amount of time that we have, because I don't get many chances to do it, and because Evadne is complex and there's a lot going on. And I find that I look forward to each scene, and some of them are such mammoth scenes that I can't even, when I start the play, I can't even look to where I'm going. I can't even imagine Act 5.
Yeah.
I really can't. It's like, oh, this is what I do in this scene. Okay, now I'm ready for this. And there, it's one of the things that I love about this play is that there are these two-person scenes that are 200-plus lines, and no one else comes on.
Yeah.
Greg and I talk for 230 lines, and it's just us. And then they talk for 200-something lines, and it's just them. And then Renee and I talk. And so I don't look at it even as a whole, which is weird, because normally I do, and I can sort of see where I'm going, and I just look at each scene, and I'm like, right, we're ready on this, and then the next thing, and I really look forward to all of it. I think it's...
And that's super to hear. I mean, that's a wonderful thing to remember about the way this play is constructed, the 200-line scenes between two people. Is any of that not looking... forward, the speed at which you had to put this together, the fact that you haven't been living in it for very long.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. If we were doing it for a few more weeks, that I think that that would go away. Even last night was the first time that I sensed, I was like, oh yeah, right, I know what comes next. There's not a little...
That's
there's
so
not
funny,
a,
because we had the same conversation, like last night was the very first
time
where I wasn't in constant terror that I had no idea what was going on.
Exactly. And we do it three more times, you know? So hopefully that'll stick around. But last night was the first night that there was a little, there wasn't a little panic and underlaced, interlaced with also saying my lines and doing what I needed to do. I was like, oh, right, yeah, this can, I got this. Now I know. Oh, no, I know that. Yeah.
Good.
Greg?
I'm sorry. There's a lot of really fun moments that I had in this play. I agree with Sarah. I can't think from beginning to end, like, the scope of the journey that a mentor goes on, like, I can't think about that in Act 1 because it's so different than what happens in Act 3, so different than Act 2, 4, you know, whatever. But one of the things that I'm having fun with are those strange laugh lines.
Mm-hmm.
I guess the two examples that I have, my two favorite moments are in the final scene. She comes on, bloody hands, bloody knife, and I've got this line that's like, you're talking about something, but there's something else important that's going on right now that you're not talking about. Let me point out two facts right now. Your hands are bloody and you have a knife.
All right.
Let's bring it back to this. which is funny, and it has actually gotten kind of mixed responses.
Sometimes
it's like nothing whatsoever.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's you know, people recognize the story and recognize how ridiculous of a line that is. And I would say the single most, my favorite and least favorite and most wonderful and most dreaded and thing I love and thing I hate about this whole play is that final speech with Aspasia. It's just like, I gotta be in a really bad place to get through that, you know, and just have to believe that this woman that I absolutely love, I think he loves her so much, or else he wouldn't spend the whole damn play pining over her, like thinking that he's done her wrong, is finally in his arms, you know, and she's gone. And what do you do about that? So I'm having fun with that, and I'm just kind of a snotty, teary, bloody mess.
Awesome. Yep. Good.
Next track.
Snotty,
teary, bloody mess.
The only other thing I would talk about that I haven't yet mentioned is Kleinax, because it hasn't quite come up. I think this is some of my favorite work that I've ever seen John do. And it's interesting for me because, you know, John and I have done 80 plays together over the last 10 years. But actually, very rarely has it been just the two of us on stage. This actually happened surprisingly rarely over the years. And this season, partly I think because Ben isn't here, we now are spending a lot more time on stage, and how our characters' relationships over these five plays are different is really fascinating to me. And the Kleinax Melanchus is such a different, you know, there's so much angst with Amintor and with Evadne, and the Kleinax thing is such a breath of fresh air in some way. But I love it. It's really, I'm having a blast doing those scenes with John.
I'm really sorry that it's just only going to go. I mean, I really think, and I felt this way about Custom of the Country, and I felt, you know, their other shows were done, and I felt like, this is really interesting stuff, and I wish it could last for longer, and that we're, you know, that everybody could get to see it. And what we need to do is an actor's choice season of all the plays they wish they could have been in longer. You know,
I think that's probably an easy way to do it. Just look at the last play on the posters.
Yeah.
No, some of those have been put to bed.
We don't have to do Mad World.
No.
Yeah. Well, I was probably as happy to say goodbye to two noble Gensmen.
I want to thank Penn State Harrisburg and Meg for bringing your people. Thank you guys so very much for being part of this. You're going to see all the rest of the shows, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's so good. And I want to thank the actors again for sharing their
thoughts
with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was a Mage Tragedy ASC Roundtable, recorded before a live audience at the American Shakespeare Center's Blackfriars Playhouse in Stanton, Virginia, on March 28th, 2014. We hope you've enjoyed the podcast. You can download other podcasts for free at ascblogs.com or subscribe to all of the ASC's podcasts through the iTunes Music Store podcast directory. A Maid's Tragedy appeared as part of the 2014 spring season at the Blackfriars Playhouse. Tickets for current or future seasons can be purchased by calling the American Shakespeare Center box office toll-free at 1-877-MUCH-ADO or by going online at americanshakespearecenter.com. I'm Annalise for the American Shakespeare Center, with special thanks to recording engineer Sam Kugler. Thank you for joining us, and we'll look forward to seeing you soon at the Blackfriars Playhouse.